Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we ask for your blessing, God. Hear us. Worship with us. Help us to listen to you. Help to teach us, God. Show us your ways. Show us what we do wrong that we may fix it, and please be kind about it. We trust you, God, and ask for your inspiration and your wisdom to be given to us so we learn from you and understand you and follow you greater. We trust you, God, and ask for your blessing in your son Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. This is 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 11 through chapter 6, verse 11.
Then Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees and carpenters and masons. And they built David a house. So David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem, after he had come from Hebron. Also more sons and daughters were born to David. Now these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shammua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. Now, when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. And David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. The Philistines also went and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, and I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into your hand." So David went to Baal-perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has broken through my enemies before me, like a breakthrough of water." Therefore he called the name of that place Baal-perazim. And they left their images there, and David and his men carried them away. Then the Philistines went up once again and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. Therefore David inquired of the Lord, and he said, "You shall not go up. Circle around behind them and come upon them in front of the mulberry trees. And it shall be, when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly, for the Lord will go out before you to strike the camp of the Philistines." And David did so, as the Lord commanded him, and he drove back the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer. Again, David gathered all the choice men of Israel, 30,000, and David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal-Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, whose name is called by the name, "The Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim." So they set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, drove the new cart. And they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, accompanying the ark of God. And Ahio went before the ark. Then David and all the house of Israel played music before the Lord on all kinds of instruments of fir wood, on harps, on stringed instruments, on tambourines, on sistrums, and on cymbals. And when they came to Nacon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God. And David became angry because of the Lord's outbreak against Uzzah, and he called the name of that place Perez Uzzah to this day. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" So David would not move the ark of the Lord with him into the city of David. But David took it aside into the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. The ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household.
Thank you, Dave. That was 2 Samuel chapter 5, 11 through chapter 6, 11. Any questions or comments regarding the section? Yes, Richard.
Oh, I think it's kind of the first part of here about the wars. David had an inside man behind the enemy scene. I told him all the secrets, what's going on. They're pretty cool. And then the next one, he didn't request. Didn't ask God about it. It's very interesting, I think.
He asked him. Let's see. Let's take a look. Well, yeah, he asked him both times. He got him both times, not just once. We'll discuss what God did with David the first time and how he instructed him the second time, what the difference was. With the mulberry bushes and the marching above, and that was God. Oh, the ark. Oh, you heard the ark movement. Oh, that's chapter 6, not 5. Okay, right. The ark, yes. Chapter 6. All right. Yes, the transportation of the ark and David's method the first time was different, which we haven't read the second time. That's the next one up here, because there's a reason I broke them up into two sections. The second time David decides to move the ark, he does it differently. He learned his lesson. God doesn't like being played with. Any other comments first? Yes. Jeff, sorry. the other guy with two fingers. Go ahead.
This is another one of the commonly brought up examples of the, quote, pettiness, unquote, of God.
Pettiness. That's interesting. I mean, don't get me wrong. I can see that, sort of. He was just trying to help the ark. He didn't do anything wrong. This was unfair. But we're going to discuss a little bit about Uzziah. Is that how you pronounce the name? I think Uzziah pronounced the name. Uzziah, whatever. Whatever his name is, pronounce it the U guy. And what he did on David's behalf by doing this. Yes, Pat.
God had given them a way to transport the ark.
Correct.
There were the rings on the side and the poles, and that was the way it was always to be transported.
Correct.
So they weren't doing it right to begin with. Had they done it correctly, he would not have had to put his hand out to steady it.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely correct. There's a reason why God prescribed the precise method of how to transport it, who gets to move it, all the details, because of things like this, so they don't happen. But, things you don't do and things by doing presumptuously, you don't read the text and find out what does God actually want. You presume to know what he wants. That was David's mistake. Say it again. Education's expensive. Yes, it is. It costs a man's life.
Rods are always there.
They always remain inside the ark. So they could have easily have picked it up in that fashion, but they opted not to. Anyway. Before we go to chapter 6, any comments to chapter 5? The things that happened in chapter 5. This was, obviously David is still growing in his kingdom. He has a battle of Philistines twice. Any comments regarding that? Things that catch your eye or attention at all?
How come the Philistines saw him being appointed as the king as the opportunity to attack? Are you going to go into that? How come that was like green light for them?
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's a good question, because note, when Saul died about 7.5 years prior to this, roughly, it may have been 8 years, one of the exact number of years, but it's over 7.5, most likely less than 10. The Philistines didn't attack for that time slot. There were no massive armies coming through. There was no major battles occurring. Yeah, there were skirmishes occasionally, but nothing significant. So why has the Philistines waited so long? It's true. It could be God's method of choosing. But there's something that Philistines wanted instead, which we're going to talk about just shortly, which is, I think, one of the main motives behind their selection of the timing.
Next. I was just wondering if there is any profound lesson behind this seemingly petty action of God.
There is a lesson. Now, whether you argue it's profound or not, I couldn't tell you that, but there is a lesson behind it. Seemingly petty. Yeah, I can understand the choice of that word, but it isn't petty. We'll discuss it, though. Yes, Susan.
I've noticed in these two chapters, the word, the verb, peretz,
yes,
is the reoccurring, the breach.
Over and over again.
First of all, because the word forth, break, to break forth, is also breach. But I'm noticing that in chapter 5, there is a breach.
Yep.
He names the name of the place,
right,
the Lord of the breach, or
yep,
the breakthrough.
The breakthrough, the place,
right,
the area of it, yeah.
And that's in a kind of a positive way, but with
right,
the breach against Perez, the Lord makes a breach against Uzzah, and for that reason, it's called Perez Uzzah.
Right.
So
it's a contrast. This is why I put these two chapters together, because they're both using that term and describing
right,
both two scenarios.
One in a positive way, one in
yes,
a supposedly negative way, but
we're going to discuss the details
in a second. Have you got more to say on this matter?
there will be more to say on that matter. That's the reason why I broke up in this chapter, the way I divided it this way. I didn't want to, because separating it out from chapter 5, chapter 6 didn't make any sense, because both, David was making a contrast there purposefully, so we would catch our attention, which I'm hoping to get to. That's, I have to get there first. So, yes, Bill.
Weren't the priests supposed to be doing this, carrying the ark and all that, getting to it?
Yes, the priests are supposed to do this. That's one of the big problems that David had. He made a mistake. Sheesh. So much for going in order. Yes, Pat. Yeah. Go ahead.
Did the Philistines come up when David was appointed king thinking that they would be welcome because he had hit out with them?
Not quite. I shouldn't say that. I don't think so. I don't personally believe that. It's possible. I don't believe that's the case. The Philistines came up, though one could argue that because of what they did and how David was able to break through them indicates something about the Philistines and what they were expecting and how they got treated. Which I'd like to get to pretty quick here, but not just yet. Any other question over here? Yes.
The Israelites took the ark up to battle many different times.
Many times, yes.
Also, the Philistines left their images, so they must have had the same practice, which would show that they were going ready to battle, hoping that their gods would fight
right,
for them.
Whether or not it was an easy kill in their perspective is what we're going to discuss. Dave, you had your hand up for a bit, too?
Just a comment. It would seem that it was a sin of presumption on David's part, and he even has a psalm saying, God, you know, take the sins of presumption or the presumption of sin, whatever, from me, far
yes,
from me.
Yes.
And that was probably one of the things he had in mind when writing that psalm.
Most likely it was. David does sins of presumption a couple of times. This is just one of the recorded points. Those of you curious, First Chronicles, like 13, 14, 15, and 16, record these same events in somewhat greater detail, but some areas not quite as much. Yes, Tammy.
Didn't David already have enough wives and concubines? Did he really have to rack up
more?
He was
a busy man. yes, he had quite a few.
My question to you is this one. Okay, verse 11. 12.
Which chapter?
After.
Oh, okay.
We're to the fifth chapter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that point, when they made an alliance with Tyre.
Tyre, yes.
That notified, somewhere it says that then David knew. Is that the right translation? That
yes,
he was going to become king? Or
they
he was
not become
king?
King. David, see.
Because of that particular incident? Or do you know?
Eventually, yeah.
It's kind of funny.
Not only that incident, but that was a rebuilding of it.
We're
going to discuss in a little bit more detail on that as well.
Very fascinating.
It's something which the king of Tyre did with David did not do with Saul.
Okay.
So David was recognizing that outside kings of other nations are now acknowledging him being king of Israel.
All right.
Even though at this point Israel is subservient to
the
Philistines.
The Philistines rejected him.
Yeah, Philistines rejected him. Yeah.
All right.
But so that's, well, I might as well get started because that's between my introduction there. yes, verse 11, of course, starts out the kingdom of Tyre. Now, where is Tyre? It's not on my map. It's off of Mexico. It's way up here, off in the middle of nowhere. My hand about a foot and a half above my map. It's in Lebanon. Lots of cedar trees, a lot of other things in there. It is a commerce city. The king of Tyre makes an alliance with David. Now, King of Tyre is very, very young at this time. It's most estimate somewhere around the age of 20, maybe late teens, when he makes this gesture toward David. So King of Tyre is doing a political move. One, I'm on your side. And number two, don't attack me. I am a young king just as you are a young king. Meaning, yeah, roughly. Not exactly, but close to that. We're both relatively new in our established kingdom. And our neighbors don't like us. So the king, the Philistines as well, Lebanon has their own issues, of course. It wasn't called Lebanon at the time. It's Phoenician territory. But they have their own issues at the time as well. Other nations nearby them, they don't like them much either. Because they have lots of money. Who is the biggest, most envied person there is? The one who has all the stuff that you want. Well, that area is very wealthy. It has a lot of merchants, a lot of travelers go through there. A lot of money goes through there. So this king of Tyre is sending a gesture toward David. He does it again 35 years later with Solomon. And Solomon becomes king. He helps Solomon build part of the temple. Get some supplies at least. Not everything, of course. So King of Tyre is relatively young. He's obviously an old man when Solomon comes along. But that he spans both kings. So he's into both kings. So at that point, David realizes that unlike Saul, when Saul was king, only Israel had to acknowledge Saul as king. Only Israel did acknowledge Saul as being king. Nobody else ever did. And the Philistines still treated him as subservient to him. So this point, David is now realizing, okay, not only, in the previous chapter, was the people of Israel anointed to be king, but now other nations are also recognizing me as the rightful king of all of Israel. Yeah, so he's now building clout, as you say. It's a political move. Perfectly fine, it's nothing uncommon. People do that all the time. Popularity. So, of course, he sends cedar wood and carpenter's wood to help build David's house. It's a very wonderful gesture, and David is quite thrilled by it. Yes, so Tammy's comment. Additional concubines and wives from Jerusalem. Did David need any more? Of course he didn't need any more. Was God going to strike him dead for doing so? Clearly not. Did God desire for David to go find more wives and concubines? Obviously not. God speaks it many times. Even Nathan, the prophet, later on discussed him with his Bathsheba, her name, discussed, hey, had you wanted her as a wife, God would have given it to her. To you. Granted, you may have lost all your other wives, but he may have given you that one if that's what you wanted, because God was favored toward you. David, of course, is not a man of patience in some instances. He is patient, but sometimes he's not, and presumption is a big problem with his. Yes.
But he's going contra to the Torah.
All right, exactly.
Deuteronomy, where it tells them,
yep.
Do
and
not
he
add
only
to
does it here, he does. He contradicts the Torah. I believe it's just twice in this section. One could argue a third time. The sin of presumption. Thinking that you know you're right and that God's okay with that is a bad place to be. Yes.
Wouldn't you say it's more, the marriages seem to be more political?
Only a few of them were. One was a princess of another kingdom. That was obviously a political move. Yes, she bore a child, but that was straight politics. Hey, let's make an alliance because the kingdom that he took a wife from were already at battle with David and they wanted to stop this. So that was one scenario. Another one, can't think of her name. Carmel, Abigail, thank you. Abigail, not so much somewhat a political move, more of, okay, you saved me. You saved me for myself, Abigail. You saved me, you helped me get through a test of God's. Had you not been there, I would have failed it. One could argue somewhat of a political move as well, of a thank you. There was a lot to it. Don't get me wrong. There was a lot to that scenario. She saved him in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but even so, she was obviously smart, but obviously beautiful too.
Right. There was physical attraction, don't get me wrong. I understand that. Right. I don't get me wrong. I understand that. He doesn't marry just because, okay, she doesn't look very good, but yeah, I'll marry it anyway. I don't think that was David's forte. Maybe even Solomon's, but not so much David's.
Well, Abigail was a widow in a way because of
yes,
David.
Yes, she was.
Yes, she was.
Yep.
These are
separate. Yep. Picked up. Local women. Keep in mind that David is no more than a person. He will do whatever he wants to do. Does he get punished for it? In many ways, he does. Does God punish David for everything that David ever did wrong? Of course not. God willing, he will not punish all of us for everything we ever do wrong. We're in a lot of hot water. So, does God overlook some things that David says, all right, that is wrong, but I'm not going to punish you with that right now? Well, yeah, he does it quite frequently. So, just because David does something wrong, doesn't necessarily mean he gets paid for it at that moment in time. Maybe later, or God may say, you know what, you've had to pay for a lot of other things right now. We'll deal with that some other time. That happens. And the portion David does, David does pay many ways for many things. Yeah. So, why did the Philistines choose now? Israel, as far as the Philistines were concerned, when they killed Saul and all of Saul's children save one, was under Philistine control. They're subservient to them. Granted, yes, the tribe of Judah in particular was not, but most of all of Israel was. And the tribe of Judah was not simply because David was around. So the only subservient issues there were on border cities, border towns, which the Philistines could go with raiding parties. Well, then guess what? David's men went on raiding parties also the other direction. So they were continuously raiding back and forth between Judah and Philistine territories. Nothing unusual about that. Philistines didn't launch a major attack because, as far as they were concerned, number one, Israel was subservient for the most part, but two, they were essentially under a civil war. Yeah. Why bother going and fighting these people? Let them kill each other first. When they've killed each other sufficiently and they're now weakened, sure, now we'll go conquer them later. It's a smarter move on the Philistines' part. They just went through a major battle. They conquered all of northern Israel, a good chunk of portions of Judah as well at the time. So it was very convenient for them to say, oh, we'll just wait, kill each other off. Okay, enough of you have died. Now we're going to send a relatively small army to go wipe out David. There's a reason why David was able to punch through the army so quickly. They didn't send a very large force the first time. David punched right through the center of it. What's the one thing you never do when you're ready to go to war and you're in a battle formation? You never head the center. That's the worst place. You've got the strongest point of an opposing army. And David's men walked right through it. Philistines weren't ready for them. They were prepared for this type of a battle. They, as somebody mentioned off, may have expected David to receive them in some fashion, or maybe not to confront them with such a great force. Because, by the way, he was fighting for them as far as they were concerned for many years. So far, maybe there's an alliance. We don't know the details. The second time, God instructed David a much more difficult method of conquering. Why? Because the Philistines were probably a lot bigger this time around. Now they were expecting a real battle. The first time, not so much. Yes, Richard.
If I remember correctly, we're talking 7 years, but before then,
roughly 7 years.
As far as the Philistines were concerned, if I understand this correctly from what you said before, that he took refuge in the Philistine territory,
yes.
So they considered him an ally.
An ally.
Now he's not the ally anymore. He's our enemy.
Now he's the enemy, yes.
Okay, that's what I wanted to...
The Philistines recognize the difference. Now, one could argue, all right, were they expecting a big battle? I don't think they were expecting a very big battle the first time around. Either they were expecting to intimidate David, or possibly expecting for David to say, oh, hey, you know, we're friends. It's all right. We're all on the same side. Or they figured David would just be easy killed because they already knew David's tactics and how to kill people. He was working with them for a long time. Granted, not directly, and they didn't know exactly what he was doing, but they thought they knew what he was doing. So there's a lot of reasons, I think, why the Philistines did not come with such a grand force the first time and were not prepared for a normal battle as David's men presented to them. Now, granted, if you read Chronicles, in the section of all the people that David's men, men David had, the Philistines should have thought twice. He had very large armies with him at this time. This before the battle took place.
They didn't have
this fight. They didn't have Baracus guys. Their CIA is needs to be fired or replaced in a little bit. They weren't very good at it. They weren't expecting very much. They didn't give very much. Thus, they lost everything. The second time, they were expecting a real battle. Now they knew the size of David's forces. Now they knew what David was capable of. Now they knew how many men they were going up against. Now let's come with real war. God just outsmarted them and told David how to outsmart by going around them. Both times, I want to point out, David did inquire of God. Both times he asked God, should I go forth, should I not? Because it's possible God did not want David to go forth. But I also want to point out, unlike Saul, David doesn't have a prophet readily available to him to ask. Saul asks Samuel lots of stuff. Hey, is this good? Hey, is that good? Is this good? Have conversations with him. Does David have conversations with God? Not exactly, no. He can inquire, Urim and Thummim, he can ask questions and God may or may not answer. That's the best he's got. So early on in David's career as king, he actually asks God many times, what's happening, what's going on. Later on, he gets prophets to talk to. Nathan, for example, is one of them. There's two prophets, I believe, he talks to.
Jesus did call him a prophet.
Yes, David himself was a prophet, which we'll discuss that later, much later. A lot more David has to do before he gets that status. So David gets to talk to God a lot. Saul didn't talk to God so much. Saul relied on Samuel for the most part. Yes, he did inquire a few times, but nothing significant. And he didn't listen anyway. I'm going to get through this because I want to talk about the breach, which is Susan pointed out quite plainly. Goes for the breach. Why does he use this term? He breached the Philistines, he called it the territory or the kingdom or whatever you call it, the Lord or the plain of the breach. And he uses it again for Uzzah. God breached. Who breached what? What was the purpose? Yes, Tammy.
Isn't that the name of his ancestor?
Yes, it is. Very well put. Thank you. That's a key point to this. What one of the key points? Let's see here. God's themes. We have to discuss the themes of God in a few weeks from now, because he's very talented at using repetition. Much, much greater than I am, by all means. What was the original breach? David's ancestor. What was that about? It was a birth. Birth of whom? And Zerah, right. Who were it? Perez and Zerah. Say it again. Twin boys from Judah. And their Tamar was their mother. What happened with Perez and Zerah? Why is Perez called breach? Well, almost born. What was the almost born part? His hand. His hand came out. They tied a red string around it. Or some kind of string around it, I believe it is. And he pulled it back, and the one came out first. It breached. It separated. Like, hey, we're going to separate or go contrary to what was planned out. Breaking forth or bursting forth in over his brother. I think this is symbolic of David's kingdom or kingship as he becomes king. In my personal opinion, broke forth. Was David supposed to be king? Way back when? Not from a heredity standpoint. He was not supposed to be king. From God's plan when he discussed stuff with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Was David thought of? No, he wasn't. When Judah had those two sons, Perez and Zerah, was that the point when God started saying, I have a plan? I'm going to start disclosing this plan slowly. What was the plan that God was disclosing with Tamar, Perez, and Zerah, and Judah? What was that plan? What was God trying to tell us who are now reading that portion of the story? Say it again. Things were going to change. There was going to be a change. Yeah, you could argue that. Things were going to change. There was a path that was going to be followed. Now God's going to divert that path. It's followed a different route. And that was the moment it started. With Tamar and Judah, Perez and Zerah being born. God changed the direction. How long did that change last? It's quite a few generations. Yes, Ellie, go ahead.
The person who was supposed to be king was supposed to be, but then he wasn't because the other guy circumvented it.
Yes.
And that same thing
happens. Someone took the kingship away.
Same thing happens with David.
Yeah. Someone takes the kingship away.
Yeah.
Attempts to, at least. Yes, Emmy.
Well, in a way, Judah did that himself. Insofar as right. Judah, Tamar was supposed to finally be married to the son Shelah.
No, the youngest. Yeah,
the youngest. Son. Yes. That did not happen. Judah usurped that. So in a sense, you know, we talk about Perez being the breach and this and that and the other, but in a way, Judah did that himself too.
So welcome. I have no argument with that at all. Personal opinion, me speaking, is that Zerah and Perez, God had original plan mapped out when those two were born. The purpose was to circumvent ownership, circumvent kingship, the line, to change the line of travel, last for 10 generations before that line was remended back together again with Ruth and Boaz. Thank you. That was generations that came back together again. They remended. It says with their descendants, but we'll discuss that later. Well, some other point. It takes a long time. That separation occurred back with Judah's time. That's the breaching forth, the breaking forth of a pattern. Something that was not supposed to happen now happened. David is now contrasting something of his own. Get here. If I can find, well, I'm not going to find it. I didn't write down which book of Genesis it was, or chapter of Genesis it was that happened. But anyway, David's recording here of his own breach. A plan that wasn't supposed to happen that's now going to happen. Why? What was God's purpose of making this happen in David's time? Why would God want us today to read about these three breaches and try to draw a connection between them? What's the purpose? What's he trying to disclose to us?
Well, one thing, he's telling the future, because that's going to be fixed. There's two witnesses of it. So David, it would appear, understood what had happened by knowing the story of his ancestors. So he's also saying, hey, there's something more coming, which the breach was repaired under Ruth and Boaz, which was a picture of the breach repaired under the Messiah.
Bringing the people back together again. Okay, a little bit of history lesson. So for those of you who have already heard this, just bear with me. I'm going to regurgitate some information to you. Where is Zerah and his descendants at the time when David is king? Who are they? Where'd they go? They wandered. Where'd they go? North and west. So what are they doing at this point in time when David becomes king of Israel? What is their main claim to fame currently at this time in history? Not money. Power. We call them, we discussed this before, the one who established the city of Troy, descendant of Zerah. The one who established Athens, descendant of Zerah. The one who established Rome, descendant of Zerah. These are men who have established massively, will be, huge kingdoms, which wind up taking over control of a whole Middle East for short periods of time, of course. So these men have grown and expanded their own kingdom. What has David's line done the past 400 years? Barely hanging on. His kingdom is on a thread. God, please don't break it. I have nothing except this. While on, yeah, a little red thread, on Zerah's side, what are their kingdoms? They're growing massively. I mean, they're the ones who created what we call Greek law and of government, which our own body of government now runs by, the whole idea of representative government. Zerah's line did that. Zerah's line created that in the Greek philosophy. They built all these things, and they progressively moved further west. And of course, yes, they obviously the Rome, and of course, we'll discuss that. We discussed it a while ago, but that's what's going on here. So when David notices, all right, there was a breach that allowed me to become king way back with Tamar. I am now king. I have a very small kingdom. It is very fragile, easily broken yet again. Compared to the people who were supposed to be king of Israel, are now far greater than I. Hundredfold greater. Thousandfold greater in many ways. By the size of their kingdoms and the wealth they have, the wisdom that they've gotten, these are men who far laps David and eclipse him on what they've done. There's a reason why Solomon's compared to them. And Solomon's, he's as smart as all of these other men who've done all these wonderful things, and he rattled them all off, and they're all descendants of Zerah. Why is Solomon the wisest man on earth compared to these men? Because what these men accomplished by the time Solomon became king was far greater than anything David or Solomon ever did. So when David's saying this, he's noticing, okay, God, you give me a very fragile kingdom. I am very weak right now, and I'm asking for help. God helped him. He breached the Philistine line. Perez is going to continue coming forth. They breached it. Okay, my breach that happened way back when is still being established. God has not forgotten, has not quit. He's going to continue to grow it, which is great, which David needed in confidence. But Uzzah, David caused a breach on that one. David noticed he did something wrong. His fragile kingdom that others, Zerah's line, did not have to worry about, he knows he's in perilous condition all the time as king of Israel. Yes, God promised a lot of things to him, but he still knows God can change his mind if David decides to do something that's unacceptable to him. But Saul is a great example. Saul was even told, you could have been established as kingdom for all your generations, but because you didn't obey this one test, it'll never be stripped from you. Saul could have been king all along. We would never have even heard of David. We'd only know about Saul and his descendants had Saul not missed those tests. So it's very key in David's mind, I've got to pass these tests. These are important. Saul didn't. I have to. Consequence of being a king of God's people versus a king of just anybody. So that's why I believe that, that David is using this term, Perez, over again. Is that he's making a contrast. All right, there are things which God has done for me to continue on my kingdom, but I can easily undo it if I'm not careful. That's my interpretation. Now, you disagree with me, don't be wrong, but that's my belief why he's using these contrasting terms.
I think it's also prophetic, because this whole term of the breaker of the breach or the Lord of the breach, it's picked up in Micah, and it is picked up in Matthew, where Yohanan the Baptizer says, the kingdom of heaven is being taken by force, and violent men take it by force.
That's a good point.
Okay.
Good point. Yes, that's
so
right. The same philosophy.
Just as David, God is the breaker of the breach. He actually had to snatch the kingdom from Saul to give it to David. And it's also prophesied, I think it's in Micah 2:11, the same term is then used. And then when John the Baptist, he's actually saying the kingdom is being taken by force because it's to do with the making a whole. Later on in the Gospel of John, he says, you will go in and out and find pasture. And if they're going, Yeshua, he is the breach maker. He makes a hole through the kingdom of Satan, Hoshek, to bring light so the sheep can go in and out. It's the whole picture of Jerusalem. It's very interesting.
That's a very well put. That's excellent. I hadn't thought about the Matthew. I heard about the Micah and I read that, but the Matthew, that's a good point. It didn't even cross my mind.
David Dorff, and he was the one that made the link between Micah with the same situation.
Same picture was great. Interesting. That's great. I didn't even think about that. That's a wonderful one.
So this is prophetic.
That it is prophetic in that fashion. That's a good point. Ellie, you had a first.
Just the same thing as Susan was saying. The fact that we've got darkness is starting to cover the earth. And right before God sent death in Egypt, he sent darkness so thick that they could feel it. But there was light in the houses of Israel. But when he sent that darkness, he snatched the people out of Egypt and broke the kingdom to get us out. And that's what he's doing in a larger sense as his kingdom comes. He'll snatch us away from the... Snatch us out of the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Same image, same theme behind it. Interesting. Richard, hands up.
Oh, I was just thinking about this. It seems like the very common pattern. You go back to the Torah, you see it's called a pattern. I was also thinking of Jacob and Esau. It was reversed.
Swapped it.
Same. The, it should have gone this way. It didn't. God switched it.
Ephraim and Manasseh.
Yeah. Same thing.
God swaps them quite regularly. He selects the one that's not supposed to be it. He chooses them anyway. We're going to go forward a little bit further. Sorry about that, but I'm getting past my time. I already am past my time. Okay, so a little faster here. I apologize. So David's course, they come forth. My text says they burned all the idols. Some of you argue they carried them off. Minor detail. Chronicle says they burned them. It's unlawful to be profitable from an idol. So all the idols from the Philistines are left behind. They crushed, burned, and disposed of them. You're certainly welcome to melt it down again and use to make something else out of it. That's perfectly fine. That's nothing wrong with that. But idols themselves usually get wiped out or destroyed. Let's see here. Oh, where to go a little? Okay. Chapter 6. David has been trying to establish Jerusalem ever since he entered it as the central city of all of Israel. We discussed this before. Jerusalem is not the location of anything. It might be Mount Moriah. We don't know. It's been debated that it might be where Isaac may have been almost sacrificed. But we don't know that for sure. It's just a tradition. But he loves this city. And the best way to establish it is bring God there. Makes a permanent town. Means you have to have a home that God now can dwell and live in. We all know that David doesn't get to build that home. We know Solomon does, but that's a later issue. So David's presumption, which is why his kingdom, he realized how precarious his kingdom actually is. He presumes and says, all right, I need to move this ark. Now granted, this ark was put in its current place before David moves it 20 years earlier. Now David is somewhere approaching the age of 39-ish, 40 years old. Not quite 40, but thereabouts, when he decides to move the ark. So David was roughly around late teens, borderline 20, hard to say exactly, when the ark was taken by the Philistines, back when Solomon became the judge. Samuel became the judge. And of course, Saul becomes king shortly thereafter. So 20 years pass by, and David pulls the ark out. What does he do? We discussed this. He broke two rules by doing this. First rule, transportation of the ark. Is a cart, whether it's brand new or not, driven by oxen or not, an acceptable method to move God? No. Is using the two men whose job had been for the past 20 years to tend to and maintain the ark in its current condition, whatever the condition, however they maintained it, using them to move the ark, is that lawful? No. So when David asks this rhetorical question, so it appears rhetorical, in chapter 6, verse, I think it's, where is it? Oh, verse 9. How can the ark of the Lord come to me? Is he asking that question of himself or out loud, meaning that this could never happen, we could never bring the ark to me? Or is he actually asking the question of his advisors, how can the ark come to me? He's afraid, but he gets the answer. In 1 Chronicles, I believe, chapter, if I get this right. No, 13 is the first time they move it. Chapter 15. David actually yells out, declares. Verse 2. David said, no one may carry the ark of God but the Levites of the Lord. For he has chosen them to carry the ark and to minister before him forever. So David knew the answer. He asked this question. He realized, I screwed up. Was David angry with God for killing Uzzah? Who was he angry with? Himself. He was the result. He was responsible for Uzzah's death. Not Uzzah, not God. Because in Numbers, it quite clearly states, which I know is chapter 4, I think it's verse 6, I think it is, I think it's verse 6. Or 15, I apologize, verse 15. No one but Levites are allowed to move it, and no one is allowed to touch it. Whether you're Levite or not, I don't care. So Uzzah, not being Levite, he's not allowed to move it. Not being flesh, he's not allowed to touch it. See, by order of the king, made two mistakes, costing him his life. And it falls upon David. I have a question for you. What if the Ark of the Covenant had fallen and hit the ground and broke? David is responsible for it. So Uzzah gave his life to save David's. You destroy God's house, what's going to happen to you? He killed other men more holy than David for that. You destroy the seed of God, guess what's going to happen? God could have easily killed David. He already had many sons already. He could have chosen any one of them and still fulfill all the promises he ever wanted. That wasn't a problem. Uzzah saved David's life. David was angry with himself because he cost Uzzah's life. Yes, David.
That was evident by him fearing God that day and didn't do anything for another 3 months. It was like a quickening. I'm sure when that happened, it was just like, boom, he knew he did wrong.
He knew he did wrong. Yep.
Tell me something.
Go ahead.
They may have known the rules.
All along?
All along.
I'm inclined to believe they did. I'm inclined to believe that they because I think, personal opinion, David thought he would get away with it because that's what the Philistines did. Oh, well, the Philistines used a new cart, and they used animals and ox, or the calves, whatever, and they moved, and see, God directed it, so that's fine. I can use it too. Philistines, number one, didn't want to even come near that thing. They've already been through a lot. They've endured a lot of torment from that thing. So they're not going to get somebody to carry it on their shoulder, no matter who you are. No Philistine's going to volunteer for that. So getting a cart and giving calves to do it, Philistines didn't know any better. They don't have a Torah on their books. Oh, quick, is that acceptable behavior? No, their priests, the Philistines, told them to do that. That's what they did. They used that method, which was acceptable. Does God hold you accountable for nothing, for something that you have no knowledge of, never been taught? Well, what's the gain of that? What's the point of destroying you if you know nothing? Have you learned anything from it? No. It doesn't help him at all. But if you know better, you know the rules, you know how it's supposed to work, and you purposely say, that's okay, we're going to circumvent them. Because, you know, God's on my side. God doesn't like that. He didn't like it before with Eli. He didn't like it with David. Not an acceptable behavior.
So they were taught all of this?
David would know this.
From
the Levites,
since they
every
were really
Levite would
small.
Know it. Every Levite would know it.
Everyone.
And so everybody involved in this, and granted, he said he gathered, 30,000 troops? Who in Israel didn't know he was going to move the ark? To gather that many troops, everybody in Israel knows what he's doing. Because word would have gone out. So all the Levites, granted, who were actually in and around the city that the ark was being moved from, so even if you didn't know, you'd see standing there, oh, hey, look, they're moving the ark, because I can see it from where I'm living, my own personal front door, and I can see, have a great view of it. They all knew what was happening. So yeah, and for not anyone to ever speak up, unlikely. David also had access to the high priest, because they were good friends at this point in time. Again, he knew. He had the knowledge. It was available. Whether the peon necessarily knew everything, probably not. But does the peon have to? No, they don't. The people who are in charge, who are actually doing everything, they're the ones who are supposed to know. Supposed to act accordingly. Yes.
You think of it this way, at least in the back of your head, you know right and wrong.
Yes. Back you know, you know right and wrong.
It's there.
Yeah.
You know right from wrong.
Yeah.
Whether you do it at any one particular time, who knows?
It's a story.
It's a different story. But we all know in the back of our heads what's right and wrong. So I think most of the people, at least those ones that were elders of the communities, that were older, maybe older than
but
David.
Knew what to do.
They should have known what to do. And the Levites certainly should have stepped forward when they saw David in his little
doing
plan.
Something he
like,
shouldn't
wait a minute.
Done. Yeah. Hold
and
it,
stepped forward
stop.
And said something. And yeah. They did not. So yeah. In some ways, maybe they are somewhat to blame for the situation too, not just David.
It's possible. It's possible. My inclination, because David in the past, in the previous chapters discussed, well, it's in 1 Samuel, cites and is very careful about obeying God's law. He had to have known certain things about the law to have obeyed them. Because he knew certain details about it. So for him to have had that much information, at least the basic details, all right, this is how you talk to God, this is when you talk to God, and this is when you don't talk to God. This is how you come near God, if you're clean or unclean. He knew how to make himself clean, how to make himself unclean, and what the rules regarding that were. He had some basic working knowledge. And to say, all right, he was even unaware that Levites are ones responsible? No, because he had high priests around him. He knew who were Levites. All right, so he knew Levites had a particular connection with God, independent of his own. I think this is no different than Uzziah's many years, generations from this point in time, the acting perception, walking into God's temple. Think, well, I'm king. And what's David saying? Well, I'm king. Doesn't work that way. You still have to obey the law. Yes.
I was saying, you know, if God doesn't change, if he's the same God yesterday, today, and tomorrow,
yep.
It's simple stories like this that humble me and make me go back and go, okay, if he, you know, if something this small deserved this kind of response for him, and he's the same God today as he was then. Any concept of, oh, the law's been done away with, or any of that meshuggah that's out there is completely debunked. Other than he has grace for us through the sacrifice of Jesus Yeshua to begin to fellowship with us. But to walk therein and to walk in his ways is a very serious matter still.
It's not petty. I also want to point out one other thing. Uzzah's death, is that a very big deal for God? Am I actually a dead person? Does that mean anything to him? Minor. It's a minor detail. How many people has God either killed or ordered killed up to this point? A lot. So many. They all died. Well, eventually, they all died. No one lives forever. But God, it's not that big of a deal. Okay, yeah, he's dead. It's all right. Move on. God doesn't bring him back if he has to, or he served his purpose. Note, Uzzah and his brother served God for 20 years. They knew what they were doing, and God said, essentially, Uzzah, thank you for your service. You're done now.
He did think enough of him because he was mentioned by name. And
yes.
That is significant.
That's right. Yeah, not many people are mentioned by name in the Bible. That's true. I'll give him credit for that. So there's one thing before I close. So David's fearful. He understands he did something wrong. It wasn't Uzzah and it wasn't God. It was David's fault. He recognized that. So when he does this, what is his solution? Temporary one at that. Hey, Lalo. He dumps the ark where? Who is Obed-Edom? Who is this guy? So this is a Gittite? No, that's a different person. The house is coming from as one who had the ark after the Philistines. That's I forgot his name. Yeah, he was a Levite. That's the key. He's a Levite. So David knew, smart enough to realize, okay, let's not drop this ark in anybody's house. Let's put it in somebody who is responsible and knows exactly what they're supposed to do. Now, Obed-Edom gets a job later. When the ark is successfully transported in the correct fashion that God ordains, Obed-Edom gets a gatekeeper's position on the main temple, which is a good bump up from what your normal day is, as a Levite. He is a Levite. It's recorded in Chronicles 15, at least 15. Yeah, 15 verse 18, I think it is. It records who he is. He's a Levite, one of the Levite families. So David knew, I made my mistake. I killed this person died because of my error. I did something presumptuously, believing that God was in my house, God believed with me. Then I was wrong. I'm going to correct it. He dumped it in a Levite's home who he knew, this person won't screw up like I did. This is the safe place to put it. As a result, God blessed it, and David learned his lesson. Do not act presumptuously.
We should learn the lesson.
We should too. If God willing, we learn the lesson. Do not act presumptuously. Whether God is with you or against you makes no difference. You do not break his laws.
Daniel, the name Uzzah means strength. There's also a little picture there. He was probably a big, strong man. Strong enough to catch the ark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be heavy. It had the commandments.
It's mostly gold.
Stones,
it's four men to carry it normally.
The stone in there, too.
Yeah.
You know what, though? It's just a lesson. It doesn't matter how strong you are. Don't mess with God.
It is. It is. So was it a petty lesson? No. It wasn't a petty lesson because somebody who was very, very, we all look up to, a very important person, had to learn humility and know that he was responsible for an innocent man's death. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I think in the answer to the accusation about pettiness is in what you were just bringing out before, that death is not a big deal to the
True.
Creator of the universe
it's
who
not.
Can bring people up and take them down.
He does it all the time. Yeah, as far as taking people down. I'm bringing up not so often, but at least the taking down for it happens all the time. Death is not that big of a deal to God. So we would think, oh, what's a big deal to us? Because we're flesh and blood. So it means a lot to us. And in God's case, it's really not. You're alive until I need you, and when I don't need you anymore, I don't need you, so go away. Move on to the next guy. It's not that big of a deal, not the end of the world. Was his family upset? Probably.
Yeah.
David clearly was upset, but it wasn't the end of the world. It wasn't that big of a hit. Yes, Jeff.
But I think the idea of the resurrection is very important to this, because those who do not believe in God value death very highly, because
true.
That small little bit that you're on the planet then ends, and
right.
that's it. However, if you're dealing with God who can bring the people back up again, resurrect them, then it is not a big deal.
That's a good point.
Death loses its sting, truly.
Yes, that's a very good point, which may also bring to, as a wise man says, oh, it's such a petty, such a big crime, such a petty item, would make sense if your mind was in the set that life is everything. Question whether a person, how much a person believes God. Not believes in it, but actually believes God. Yes, I didn't close up. Yes, Carrie?
It strikes me as extremely arrogant to make such an assertion. He obviously, anybody who would make that accusation obviously does not have a healthy fear of God. Who is somebody that can strike you dead at whim?
Very true. Very true. Have a wonderful remaining Shabbat. God keep you all safe.